When your company earns unlimited 2% cash back on all purchases with Capital One, that's serious business. So, Steven at SandCloud got a serious business card, the Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One.
We used our 2% cash back to help build our retail presence.
Savvy, Steven.
And we get big purchasing power, so our business can spend more and earn more.
The Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One. What's in your wallet?
Terms and conditions apply. Find out more at CapitalOne.com/SparkCashPlus.
Welcome to the Trish and Sarah Wrestling Podcast. I'm Sarah.
I'm Trish.
And this is our podcast. We talk about wrestling news and various topics from different promotions, primarily AEW, but also New Japan Pro Wrestling, WWE, and topics from around the wrestling world. Whatever we find interesting, and we hope you will too. We are a proud member of the Social Suplex Podcast Network, and you can find our content on our podcast feed, the Social Suplex Podcast feed, as well as on Twitter, Blue Sky, and YouTube. Please feel free to like, subscribe, and rate our podcast. We have a store at Chopped Tees, so if you would like to support us or just own a really cool quality piece of clothing, please take a look at chopped-tees.com/socialsuplexnetwork. And the Social Suplex Network also has a newsletter, which is published bi-weekly at socialsuplex.com and has features, reviews, and tons of news from wrestling promotions throughout the world. So please, if you have some time, dig in and learn what's going on in the world of wrestling. Today is Sunday, June 15, 2025, and after a slightly longer than normal hiatus, Trish and I are back, ready to discuss wrestling, ready to talk about everything going on in the world of our, I don't want to say our favorite promotions, all of the promotions, the promotions. And we're going to kick things off today with AEW, which has really, you know, had it paid all the tolls, filled up the tank, and is cruising right on down the road to All In, with ticket sales picking up, promotion of the show picking up, angles picking up. Trish, they seem to be really making a move to make this the biggest show of the year.
I think it's the big thing about this year's card, I think, is that it has a bit of something for everybody already. So they're obviously going to run a triple main event.
Yes.
I know that annoys everybody.
That's what they're going to call it.
That's what they're going to call it.
Yes.
That's what they're going to call it. But when I think about this year's card, there is things that interest me, just things that seem to interest everybody. Whereas I think last year was very much kind of, I know a lot of people we spoke to outside Wembley on that day were just kind of like, yeah, we're going because it's stadium show, but there's nothing like I'm really heavily invested in. You know, there definitely was people that invested in the Danielson Swerve match.
Yes.
But outside of that, there wasn't a huge amount. So I think they've done a much better job of kind of splitting the kind of feel of things this year, and you can see, you know, even some of the matches that aren't announced, you can see how they're going to line up already as well. But
yes.
In terms of the top three, you know, what I find really interesting is that they've got really kind of different approaches. So we've got the Mercedes Tony story, where you have the Belt Collector versus the champion of AEW. And, you know, they started very much with their big promo at the start.
Yes.
And
week one.
To me, yeah. And I think, like, it was a very good promo. I thought Tony was just phenomenal. But the hardest thing for them now is that you now have to carry on that for the rest of, you know, the duration of the build. And I think they actually had the toughest job of the three stories.
Yes.
Because you've had that big moment. And, you know, what is there that you are building with? You know, what interpersonal things are there? Are we just, is Mercedes, you know, Mercedes going to pick up obviously another belt in Mexico this week? Is it just seeing her as a threat? You know, the kind of everything that's followed has kind of been kind of standard stuff. So I'm really interested if they can keep momentum or even build momentum back up. What have you thought of that story so far?
I think it's been good. I think I'm not expecting more than what we're getting, which is tag matches and some, you know, shenanigans. Because like you said, I do agree that they blew their big promo early on, and they don't seem to be putting, there doesn't seem to be the emotional hook to it that, like, for example, Tony and Mariah had. You know, and I do think the Belt Collector stuff will be interesting. You know, obviously, Tony's been having her matches. We'll see Mercedes having match this week, and obviously expect Tony to be close by at ringside or something along the lines to do something similar back to her, which will be funny. But yeah, this is one of those.
What's she gonna have? Is she gonna? She's not gonna have steak, right? No. What's Mercedes?
God only knows. A giant turkey leg, like something. It's gonna be whatever it is. It's gonna be deranged in the best way possible. I'm gonna be living for it. But yeah, this is one of those ones where, you know, I'm expecting it to be an absolutely spectacular match. I think that they have great chemistry. I'm enjoying the sniffing. But in terms of, you know, like an emotional hook, there's not too much there. It's really just the personalities of the two of them that are kind of drawing you in, which, you know, I'm fine with.
I think maybe the big question around this is not just that match in itself, but the current kind of lack of build for another or even, you know, more than one women's singles match. Do you think that it's hurt them by putting these two together in terms of the entire women's roster? Or do you think that there's enough to gain out of doing, you know, the biggest, honestly, the biggest match they have possible right now in that division and one of the biggest matches in the company on this show?
I think it's a benefit to the company overall that they are doing the biggest match possible. I think it's a and I think it's a benefit to Tony, I think, if she wins. I think the downside of that is that it leaves less room for the other women on the roster, a couple of whom would clearly be in bigger spots if Tony and Mercedes were both available, right? We had a lot of promos and, not promos, we had a lot of promotional work done by Athena when they announced All In last year. That seems to have disappeared completely off the radar, although she and Thunder Rosa are, like, clearly doing something, you know, whether that's something that's planned or whether they're just trying to work some stuff on their own.
It looks like it could be Super Card of Honor, which is not probably what you want when you're when you've been promoting the main one. Yeah,
no. So, like, on that level, it's one of these, like, double-edged sword type of things. Like, I think the benefit of having the match is better for the overall promotion, but I do think it limits. They need to come up with something stronger for a secondary women's program, because they can't just have one women's match on this card. And I don't mean, like, pre-show. I mean the whole thing, right? Like, they have to have another women's match on this card.
And it would be better if we had one that felt built. You know, I think we might get a spin-off or some sort of kind of mixed tag involving, you know, Chris and Willow and the Death Riders and Marina. But that's not really a woman's story. You know, that's a story built off the, you know, the main title, men's title story. So I would like to see something else being built, you know, for that. And I don't feel like we have seen anything that feels so, you know, as strong as some of the kind of secondary matches on the men's side being built yet. So, yeah, it's definitely an interesting one. And I guess it's something that we can't really judge until we see what happens at that show and then what happens after. Yeah. You know, that'll be whether we know where that balance is. But yeah, I think they have the most difficult of the kind of the situations, but they also kind of live in a bit of an element where it can be used to drive, you know, local ticket sales late on, but it also encourages some fly-ins. But it's kind of not one or the other, whereas I think the two main MEMS programs kind of fit one of each. So then you have, like, so Omega and Okada, which has been, you know, we've all known it's been in the works since last year. They've been looking at the All In sign.
They're pointing at the sign, occasionally like pointing at each other, occasionally pointing at a belt, you know. Very WWE build.
Yeah, so we had to kind of get past that. And I think I'm kind of glad that they did sort of move on from that in the last couple of weeks. But what was really funny is when you think about it, so I am in favor of them getting Don Callis into this angle. Because
it can't hurt.
They need a talker.
Yeah.
I think if you look at, you know, Omega, especially since he's come back, I think it's pretty clear that for something like this, he could really do with someone to bounce off of or someone to kind of not rescue the situation, but control the promos in a way that Don Callis can. Yeah. But it almost feels like they've retconned the entire Elite Omega angle from last summer.
Yes. Yes. Like, that's like there's no... you know, Tunnel Talk was discussing that in their show yesterday, where they talked about the fact that Kenny's like, oh, let's do another dance, as opposed to like, hey, you freaking, you know, you stole my friends and my spot in the Elite. Like, that's just gone. Like, it's just like, you know, oh, two old rivals doing it one more time. And I'm like, what? I don't know. It's weird. It's a little weird.
I think it's one of the things when you look at the promo that Kenny cut when he came back, when the Bucks came back, sorry. And you probably just thought, look, this is dead in the water then. So what do we do now? And they want to make it more than just kind of the two-hour rival thing, because you need to make it relevant to people in AEW. And they ran the video package, very good video package. How much do you think that changes the thoughts around and the feelings around this match for people that have never seen, you know, the previous matches between Omega and Okada?
I don't think that it made that much of a difference. I mean, video packages are great. Like, video packages are great, right? But video packages hit really well when you already have that emotional connection. If it's just like, hey, you should like this because of reasons, it's less, I don't know, it just, you still need some reason to watch every week, like to want to see it. I just feel like I don't, again, it was a fantastic video package, but you can't build a feud out of video packages.
No, and that's why I think they have to kind of do something here, and that's why they went with the heavy heat angle with the blood and, you know, the elbow
heavy
into
heat
the
dug-
What?
No, oh. very heavy heat angle.
Well, it was, well, you know. But that's what, they went for, the with the blood angle and, you know, the elbow into the diverticulitis and it was a very effective visual. And it's probably the right time to do it, because when you look at that match is a fly-in match, right? Yeah. If you tell, you know, that's not a story that you could tell as well locally. And that's not to disrespect the fact that, you know, 6,000 people watched the first day of the G1 in Dallas in 2019. But it's not as easy to go out and promote other than, you know, two guys with belts, we're going to see who's the best. It's not as easy media friendly. They have an easier story for that. This is your fly-in match. This is the people you're trying to get, the people that were invested in, you know, 2018, 2017, New Japan, people that, you know, are still invested in Okada, still invested in Omega, and who wanted to see that match and maybe didn't get to see it in Japan, but can see it now. And that's what you're aiming at. And I think that's why you do it now. So we're in that kind of spot now where you're looking at you maybe the last couple of weeks of people thinking about actually flying in. Or driving in long distance. So it's probably the worthwhile to do it at this spot. It's just a case of where, you know, how they follow up from it.
We've sort of expected the belt unification element of this for quite a long time. Mm-hmm. What do you think of it and the way that they've set it up? Like, what are your, you know, what are your thoughts on, you know, unifying these titles and, you know, all that good shit?
I mean, we've talked about this for, since they started talking about it, really, which was, we talked about it when they were talking about Shockwave.
Yeah.
And last October, September, October, November, somewhere around there. And it just felt like this was always where it was going to go. You know, as soon as they set this match up, it was always going to be for, you know, both belts and unifying them. And then you create a secondary world title, you know, the equivalent to, you know, WWE have their world heavyweight, don't they? Their secondary world title. And it's a similar thing, and I think it's a representation of the logjam that is at the top of AEW. And then, you know, you need to think about what you're going to do with Collision. So depending where, and we'll talk about that later on, but depending what they do with Collision, then you probably need a figurehead around each brand. Especially if you're going to have both as like, you know, similar level shows, if you're going to try and present them as a 1A, 1B show rather than the A and B shows that we currently have. Especially if they're both on weeknights, then having kind of two world champions is not the worst thing in the world. It's difficult when you look at the AEW men's world title over the last few years, because I don't think it's at the same stature level as it was a few years back.
No.
Because of everything that's kind of happened. But it still would sit above. So you then, but then the big challenge with that is, it will depend who's holding these titles, will depend which one is seen as more important.
Yes.
And it's what we talked about when we talked about the Owen final, wasn't it? And when we talked about the tournament in general, that if you give, we literally said this, if you give, you have to be really careful who you give the world title to next. And it's when we talked about, when people keep saying about, you know, it potentially going, I think they had it like Ospreay to Darby Mox to Darby to Fletcher. And it was like, well, if Omega has the other title, then, you know, you're in danger of being eaten up. So that's sort of thing where you have to think about that. But I can see it as something they feel like maybe they need to do because of how much top talent they have. But you also have to be careful about making them still important, because otherwise you just have belt after belt after belt. I think there was something you wanted to talk about around the design.
Yeah, this was sort of a minor, slightly annoying point. But the fact that the side plates are Omega and Okada on this new belt slightly irritated me. Because it again is a situation where, and AEW has done a much better job of this lately, where they're using their own history and not other people's history. But in this case, you know, Omega and Okada as a rivalry is a New Japan rivalry. You know, we've seen it. You know, what we just joked about at the top of this segment, you know, the whole point, what we've seen in AEW has been pointing at the sign and pointing at the belt and staring at each other. You know, you've got your international, your great international champion is Orange Cassidy. Like, there's no, I don't think there's an argument a single person could make on that. And I think you could say that the Continental title was more associated with Eddie Kingston than anybody else, than Okada, who didn't really defend it that often. I don't know. Like, so that was one of those things where I was like, you've chosen to basically make a belt for a New Japan rivalry. Is it one of the greatest rivalries and great matches in wrestling? 150%. Absolutely. But is that an AEW thing? Like, I don't know. Like, this is where I kind of am like, that's the thing where I'm like, yeah, you're being too hard on it. It's, you know, yada, yada, yada. But that was, it was something that kind of occurred to me yesterday. I was like, yeah, that sort of suck.
Yeah, it's a shame that it doesn't acknowledge, especially Eddie and Orange Cassidy. Because that's more of the history of those belts than, you know, especially, you know, unfortunately for Omega. You know, he's had the belt for, what, a few months? Barely defended it.
Yeah.
You know, Cassidy had that thing for, you know, for a year. And yeah, so, yeah, it's, hopefully it's something they can do. Maybe add some more plates, you know. They love making belts longer. Just add, make some more plates. Come on
It's
now.
The most expensive belt they've ever made, apparently.
Well, you can make some more plates. They've got new TV money. They're all right.
TV money, baby. Although, I don't know, WBD, that's going, they're screwed. We've had a whole thing.
No, we're not doing it. No, nobody knows. On. Let's not pretend we know.
We can't pretend we know. There's literally nothing to that.
It's impossible to know. Right. Yes, we're not doing that one. I'm not doing it. Sure. Right. Okay. And then the other story, which is a combination of not just the world title story, but also the story predominantly between Paige and Swerve. And this one's been very different because they have not gone from, you know, all guns blazing from the start. This one is the building story. So this one, you know, we haven't had a promo face to face with Moxley and Paige both from microphones yet. You know, we're still not at that point. You've got the undercurrent of the stories with Swerve and Ospreay and everything that's going there. So we're building very, very slowly up with this one. And I think that's probably the right thing to do because this is your local driver at the end. You know, Paige is essentially, maybe not your closer, but you're like your clutch hitter sort of thing. Where that's the easy story to tell to the local audience, you know, to that market. Never mind the fact he's a cowboy in Texas, but, and, you know, the press runs it all do around that. But it's like, this is your triumph story, right? Because the other two, they're all successful.
Yeah.
So this is a, who's the best of the best? Okay. Yep. That's a sellable story. But emotionally, you know, am I desperate for a Carter to win? Am I desperate for a Mega to win? Am I desperate for Tony Storm to win? Am I desperate for Mercedes Moné to win? And I'm absolutely sure there are, but from an emotional standpoint, I don't feel that way. I want to see who wins, but I'm not emotionally invested. It doesn't make me kind of, you know, think about it night and day. It's like, there's nothing to that. Whereas this is your triumph story. And being very clear, this is your triumph story.
Yes.
If you have got it through your fucking head that it's not happening, you need a turnaround.
Yeah.
Okay?
Look at what they're showing you on television.
Yeah. Like, you don't
take a lesson from us last episode and going into the Owen and pay attention to the story that you're being told on television. Because
we're not falling for it again, right?
Yeah.
Last time we ignored it.
We smartened up.
last month we ignored it and couldn't understand what the fuck was going on TV with what we thought was going to happen. And actually this time we're just watching the TV. You don't even need someone to tell you. Whether someone tells me or not is irrelevant. You don't need somebody to tell you because you can watch this and you can see exactly where it's going to go. And I think that's why, you know, the people that were paying close enough attention to the TV over the last few weeks had already worked out, you know, Swerve and Will was coming way before All In. You know, whereas everyone else was like, oh, that'll be the All-In match. And it's like, well, no, watch what they're doing here. You know, this tension has to go now because they need to get to the point where they're on the same page for All-In.
Yes.
Like, it was pretty obvious to us and to, you know, a lot of people around us, but it wasn't to other people because I think there was such a set mindset of, oh, this is the match we're getting. It's like, no, but this is what's on TV. And when it comes to Paige, what's on TV, that story is he is winning at All In.
Yeah.
They are running advertisements where they're not going, They're not doing the same thing that they're doing with Mercedes and Tony, where they're going, it could be this or it could be that. There's no Moxley voice in these adverts. It's no. In 7 weeks, I am winning that belt. That's it. They are selling it to you. That's what the promos. And if you're going about the promises, yeah, he made that babyface promise. He's winning the belt. And the other babyface promise is because he's not an actual true babyface yet in his character. You know, yes, he's right. A babyface in terms of his positioning. But, you know, and some people don't like when they do this, but it's important because what they're doing is he has to kind of earn being a babyface before the music comes back, before he doesn't walk out the heel tunnel, you know. And with him, it's like he has to be able to accept help. He has to be able to accept that he's more than his trauma, which, you know, what Will and MJF have been playing on in recent months. And the way you're doing that is the story that they're telling now with Strickland, with the Bucks, you know, with the Ops coming out and then Hangman, like, just not even acknowledging them as he tries to do everything by himself. So that's the build up to it. And it means that you're not getting, you know, similar to what you saw with Cody and The Rock, where you do the one big promo and then there's nothing. And then it peaks out.
Narratively, it's more interesting that you have so many different threads winding through the same story, right? That you have the Young Bucks, like, you know, dancing around trying to mess things up or not messing things up, that you have the conflict between Ospreay and Swerve, that you have the conflict between Hangman and Swerve, that you have the sort of semi-conflict between Hangman and Ospreay, that, you know, that otherwise it's just, like you said, it's just Mercedes and Tony sort of staring at each other weekly and doing tag matches, right? Which is fine, but not, like, you need one of these stories to have, like, some element of tension moving through it, and that's what this one is doing right now. Like, you're getting something new every week that's leading you to where you're pretty sure you're going to go, but you're not sure exactly how you're getting there, and that's what makes it interesting.
And they'll do that right up to the night, because I know, like, we're expecting, like, Darby back either before or on that night, right? Because we know he has to be the following week.
Yes.
Because of the TV promotion they've got with WBD the following week that he's already working on. So it's like, you want to bring him back. And people are like, bring him back and Sting. It'd be like the end of the Avengers. Say, no, the big moment in that match needs to mirror what happened last year, which is Swerve and Hangman, isn't it? Because, you know, if you're going to do, there's going to be interference in that match. You know, hopefully not too much near the end, but we know there is. But the last moment has to be a mirror. So Hangman, you know, there last year, causes Swerve, you know, quote his quote, to you know, the belt to slip through his fingers. Well, in this one, you know, he's going to wrap his hand around the belt in the opposite way because of Swerve. And then you can play on that dynamic afterwards, you know. But that's the moment.
Yes,
you know,
they the crowd still don't have to like each not, other.
Yeah, it's not Darby Allin. It's not Sting. The moment is between this story, which has been one of the most invested in stories, you know, by the fan base over the last couple of years. So you have to deliver that moment at the end, and everything is building towards it. So much so that that moment is almost as important as him winning that belt. and I think what they have done a good job of that people haven't really noticed so much is that they are setting up for after he wins the belt pretty quickly now. You know, no one's talking about facing Moxley after All In. You know, you've got MJF building him up as, like, nobody can beat him, I can't beat him, you can't beat him, that sort of thing. And he has to find himself as a character, but you can see once he gets to that point, then you have this champion, you know, that a lot of the guys are fearful of because they've not been able to defeat. Or, you know, so you've got that built in now, but everything's kind of being built for after rather than just for All In as well. And it's kind of going under the radar in a kind of clever way. But I think it works really, really well. So it'll give him a launch pad. And then, you know, you come out of it and you're going to have all these kind of younger guys that are at the forefront of their male division at the front. You know, complete opposite to where we were, you know, the end of last year and, you know, the autumn, the winter. So that's kind of really important. And that's what you're putting against WWE running, you know, the John Cena, the CM Punk, the... and everything else.
Well, I think that's where the joy of watching it is coming from me. It's not just people that I like on television. It's people that I have been desperate for, that I think the rest of the audience is going to like, that I'm desperate for people to be like, hey, like, these are your young guys who know how to tell a story, who are absolutely fucking incredible wrestlers, right? Like, that match on Wednesday was out between Swerve and Ospreay was outstanding. Like, why wouldn't you want to put them at the forefront instead of fucking old guys that we're all sort of tired of and that aren't giving us anything new? And so they're finally doing that, and it feels like it's paying off, you know? And they're using supporting characters, and they're, you know, doing funky matches like Great. Thank you very much. Like, I just think the whole thing is set up very nicely. I am enjoying watching it. It makes the shows more interesting. The fact that it's going through the whole, like, it's made the 4-hour long shows slightly more palatable, even though those have been a nightmare. But
try sitting through one live, mate. Yeah,
I wasn't doing that, so good for you. I just think the whole thing, I liked the threads of this idea that, like, you know, somebody like MJF is basically saying to Ospreay, you can't get Swerve and Hangman to work together because if they do, the rest of us are fucked, which I kind of thought was funny, where I'm like, oh, screwed. Yeah, that makes sense. But I just think all this stuff is like, it's being done well, and I'm interested to see where it goes. It's made me excited to go to All In, and I just think it's a positive. And like you said, having them do this while WWE is going back to the Goldberg web, you know, like, is good. I think it's a good choice. It's again, focus on what you're doing. Don't fucking worry about WWE. Just do what you do well and let those guys rip. And that's pretty much what's happening.
I like some of the little moments in the story as well. So even with, you know, they did the thing where Ospreay was like, I'd take a bullet for Swerve, and then he does. And then they do the thing with the Hangman. Hangman's such good at timing. So, like, even just like what he does with that thing with the Bucks, where, you know, you can look at it as, were the Bucks actually on his side and didn't even realize, and now they're going to, you know, turn against him like they did with Kenny when Kenny chose someone else, or were they trying to manipulate him? But when he does, like, the Swerve thing, you know, he leaves it that couple of seconds break, then delivers a line, and then you get the pop, and he's just so clever at that. And I thought there are a couple other things in the Moxley tying up angle, which I've seen some funny TikToks on already. I was always going to get that response. We knew what was coming as soon as it happened. But there were some funny things around that where, you know, Claudio goes to trap him with the neck.
Yes, yes.
And then Moxley pushes him away. And, you know, I think Brian Alvarez has made a good point in the last few months of trying to explain, you know, Moxley's kind of character methodology of, you know, this guy wants somebody to step up to him. You know, that's what he wants. He wants someone to step up and save AEW. Whether he's been a hypocrite about it or not is a different thing entirely. But that's like the story in the character's mind that they're trying to sell you. And I think that promo kind of did a good job at that. There was something that Hangman said that made me think, though, and I wanted to ask you what you thought of it. So he said he would walk through death. And it occurs to me that, you know, that if this triumph is going on last, then he has a lot to follow. Do you think this is going to be a Texas death match?
Oh, Yeah,
okay.
I think this, and I've thought this for a while, like, which, you know, we can't do in a stadium, Trish. You can't have a death match in a stadium. This is short of this last year. That wouldn't work. Wouldn't be a positive thing. But I think, yes, I think it will be a death match or some kind of, yes. I think it makes sense for Hangman. It makes sense for Moxley. It makes sense. They'll have some escalation in the next couple of weeks that it makes sense for all the interference that you know is coming because it's been the build of this. And quite frankly, like, I don't know. Like, in an ideal world, would I have matches in the world title with that much interference? No. But at the same time, from a narrative standpoint, you'd like to see the interferences foiled, right? If all Moxley has done is won by interference, you know. And then I would like to see him, like you said, with the Claudio stuff, like, I'd like to see, you know, him deal with the ramifications of the Death Riders. I think you could do a better job of, like, kind of semi-turning Mox back to being a face again by having him deal with fucking Claudio and Yuta and all that shit. Although, who knows, you know. Because that's the other thing. Like, Mox's got to do something, right? Like, Mox's got to do something. He's not going to just disappear into the ether, hopefully. So if he's going to do something, what are we setting up for that, right? Like, how's that going to go? Like, I don't know. I just think I'm intrigued, I guess would be the best way. But yes, I do think this is going to be a Texas death match.
And I think it probably fits in with the nature of the program so far that he's had as well. Because, you know, the most recognizable things from his reign have been the hardcore matches, right? So the spike spot that everyone went nuts over with the Copeland thing, and then the cage match, which I thought was okay, but I think a lot of people like much better than I did when it came to Samoa Joe. But they were still some of the strongest moments of, you know, his reign, and traditionally some of his strongest matches have been the hardcore element. And I think, you know, especially in that environment and everything else, and yeah, to be able to allow the interference, which you can't do with a regular match, it's a joke if you do that. So I think it makes much more sense to put it in that environment and to top off the show like that, and it then differentiates them from the other, you know, title matches that are going on before then as well. So I think it definitely feels much more balanced this year. They are really strong matches. I think they're stronger singles matches than last year, to be honest, and the year before.
Yeah,
and that's before we even get, and that's before we even get to a match, you know, like the Bucks and Swerve and Ospreay, which I imagine will have some sort of stip around the main involved as well. So, and anything else that's going to be added onto there. So, yeah, it looks a strong card. Ticket sales. This has been funny. So, do you remember last year when we went through the Wembley ticket sales and people said it stopped at 40,000 for like forever? And we tried to explain that actually seats kept getting added back into the map.
Right.
And it was selling, but it wasn't, you know, it's not like it wasn't selling anything at all. That was bollocks. It was just that, yeah, the on sale that they had at the very start wasn't as strong as what was made out to be. And there was tickets coming back in batches. And it's really hard to track this, you know, especially with a stadium. So,
well, I think that's the big challenge when it comes to this is that people think that like the WrestleTix numbers are perfect, exact, right? And they're, you know, and that's not to shit on WrestleTix because
they don't even read his example, right? No. He'll write what it is, and
yes,
they won't
and
read
nobody
it.
Reads it. Nobody reads it. They just look at the picture. So it's like, oh, they sold 1,500 tickets. It's Ospreay versus Omega, and it's like, no, they didn't sell 500 tickets.
Oh, they did 794. It's 794 in that week. Yeah,
794 is tremendous. It's one of those things where it's like people don't understand that this stuff is, it's, there's a presumption of tickets being released that suddenly they're back, they appear back on the map, and it's a realization, oh, these tickets weren't sold, now I have to reaccount for them, and that's why the number fluctuates the way that it does.
There's a new set of seats added to the map this week that currently has it on your spreadsheet, has them kind of dropping back below 17K, and we don't know yet. So it's one of those things, but the important thing actually when it comes to this isn't, you know, where that number sits currently, because we'll figure that out, you know, as we figure it out, as things come back in and out the map, that's standard as thing. And it's why you can, just the overall number doesn't really tell you the story. Because if you look at the week after Double or Nothing on a Friday, you know, they took nearly 1,700 tickets out of the map, which we thought was a county four, but came in when they did the stage change. And then like this, yeah, we've added 600 back. So now we have this 1,400 figure that everyone's touting. And it's, you know, I have no issue of AEW touting that, you know, something is successful, whether it's not accurate, but it doesn't matter because that's what you're going to do. But in terms of what's actually happening, so before Double or Nothing, you know, the 4 weeks that they had before Double or Nothing, they had weeks of 95, 126, 224, and 1 week of 767, which has about 500 comps, by the way, that it was added in. If you take the big comp week out, you know, the other 3 weeks averaged 148 tickets a week. So what have we seen since Double or Nothing? So first week after Double or Nothing is 719, second week after Double or Nothing, 634. This week up to Sunday, so missing one day, sales are up at 689. So this week will be the strongest, more than likely, of the 3 weeks. So we're looking at, you know, four times near enough, maybe five coming out of this week, of what they were doing on average in the weeks preceding, you know, Double or Nothing. So we are seeing a big pickup now. And that will hopefully continue as they go through. And the local media has been good as well. So the strongest day of last week, for example, was the Friday. And a Friday into the Saturday. And that coincided with Ricochet being in Texas doing a ton of local media. I think he lit the shield at the FC Dallas game. I don't know quite what that looks like, but that was when I got the words. It said lit the shield. I was like, it's like, is it a big shield? Is it a fire thing? Does it light up? Someone's going to send me this and get really angry that I'm fucking around with FC Dallas now. But like, what do they have? Like, I don't know. But yeah, he lit the shield. Anyway, he lit the shield. And he did a ton of local press, and that was their most successful ticket sales day of that week. So I think they have Anthony Bowens this weekend. I think he's the Grand Marshal of the Pride Parade.
Yeah,
that might be today. And then he's doing a load of press out there. And you're not even getting to your bigger people yet, which you actually don't want to do. I think it's a good strategy to be sending in, you know, your lower mid-carders, your mid-carders now. And then when you get to that kind of final press, that's when, you know, you're sending Tony Storm out there. You're sending Mercedes Monet out. Hanger's got to be out there pretty much every day. It's going to be interesting. God, we're going to have probably more press from him than we've ever heard in our life.
I know.
That's going to be crazy. But yeah, you've got to send these people out there then. You know, that's where you hit that local market really, really hard. But I think that strategy seems much, much better than what it did last year in the UK, because I don't remember seeing anything into the last few weeks. So they are doing a good job with that as well.
We had all the Brian Danielson. I don't know that I didn't they have Jeff Jarrett, or was that the year before?
He went out and did a couple of things. He did a day. Yeah, it was like a day. Yeah. We don't mention the Brian Danielson, I'm not going to sell my own story thing. I don't think Hank's going to have any troubles there.
I win the title. It's fine.
Yeah, that wasn't great.
No.
I think that there's a much clearer... I think this year that, you know, that main story has, main men's world title story has a much clearer line to it, you know? It's like, this thing's been in a briefcase. I'm on my redemption thing. Here's who I am. I'm going to be a cowboy wedding in Texas. It's very simple. And you could tell it. When they were doing the media interviews that he did in Virginia, you know, you could tell that they have a very set narrative for them. So I expect that to continue into here. But yeah, ticket sales are picking up. And I think this needs to be a little bit of a reality check on the number and expectation, but not just that, on what you consider a success. You know, because... the biggest number they've ever done in the US is 20,177 officially, which was the Grand Slam 21 number. And that one had an on sale around 16,000. So from July onwards, I think it was mid-July to middle September, they only moved just under kind of 4,000 tickets. And in fact, the last 2 weeks when after they announced, you know, the last week when they announced Omega and Danielson, they sold 900 tickets. So the fact that the late sales are going to pick up in the way that they do and they're going to overtake that number, especially with a market of around 8 million compared to a market of over 20 million in New York, is an achievement in itself. And I think we underplay it. And I think maybe because you look at the Wembley numbers or you look at Tokyo Dome numbers, but in the US, for a secondary company to be putting more than 20,000 people in a stadium is an achievement. And especially when you look at where they started from. You know, the WrestleTix numbers list the immediate kind of on sales in December as around 12,000. I think with the adjustments that we've seen to the map consistently, we're probably looking at closer to 10 by the time we get to the end of it. So in the remaining, it's very unusual to then in the remaining months be able to double your attendance. So I'm more bullish. You know, I think if they get to 20K in the last week, that I think they'll get to kind of 23, 24. I think they'd have a shot at 25. Texas is very much traditionally a late walk-up market as well. And you're going to hit the press very, very heavy in that last week. But even like just passing that 100 number is something and should be celebrated as something. And I think they have to make an effort at celebrating it as something because last year they didn't release the number for Wembley and not celebrating the fact that you distributed 52,000 people, you had 45,000 in the venue was a mistake.
Yeah. Don't view it as a failure, view it as a success. Like it, because it is a fucking success and you should be proud of it, right? Peaking these stories at the right time is very, very difficult. We've seen how hard it is to do, and yet they're managing to pull this off, and it's something that they should be proud of, right? And it started to get them, they feel like they have momentum back. Right? That you see, from an anecdotal standpoint, you see people being like, oh, I bought my all-in tickets or I'm going all in. People are very, you know, they announced Omega and Okada and people were thrilled with that. Like it's a big achievement for them and they shouldn't try and hide it just because they didn't hit some number that they hit last year that they thought they were going to hit or whatever. Like it's a positive.
Yeah. And you've got to go on what you have now. So what are you doing now? Okay. It wasn't hot in December. Fine. But where are you now and what can you achieve now and then celebrate it? Because you know, this is an opportunity to make these wrestlers as well look as big as possible.
Yeah, look like they've achieved something.
Yeah, and in a way that I like the fact that they've extended the big stage. You've got the big stage and then there's a huge, huge screen at the back of Globe Life. So use all of that. Make these people look like some of the biggest things in the world, the same way that they do when they walk out in the Tokyo Dome. You know, you must be sick of the, well, they look great when they're in the Tokyo Dome, but not so good here, all right? Because even it's true. But why is it true? Because you need to present them in a similar way. And
I mean,
I think one of the biggest things for me is that. So I've done quite a few WrestleManias, and now I've been lucky enough to do a Tokyo Dome show. And when I went, the last two All Ins have felt more like a WrestleMania style production. They haven't felt like an AEW production to me. And I don't know if that's because we're trying to cram everybody in and the curfew at Wembley is difficult, but the match choices, you know, we've had the very kind of WWE style match choices at the top of the card, especially singles matches in the last few years. And this year we're not going to see as much of that. So I want to see what is an AEW stadium show, because I don't think we've seen that yet.
I think that's an interesting point. I think that I'm not even sure what that would look like. I'm excited to see the giant, like the giant screen. I do feel like putting the screen in the back of the way there.
It's almost like being excited for a video package.
I'm excited for a giant screen. I know, right? Like I'm Alvarezing this big time. But I do feel like that would be a cool, you know, like I thought the Wembley setup last year was pretty good. I thought it was a better setup than the first year. I'm interested in this, Trish. I'm not sure where I'm going with it.
We'll see. It'd be interesting to see how I feel after that one. See this now, I'm...
There's going to be positives and negatives. There's going to be nothing is going to be perfect about this show. We're going to have to deal with stuff that we don't like. But hopefully the positives outweigh the negatives to the point where we're not even discussing the negatives.
No, I just want to see if they can establish something that feels like them.
And unique.
And I didn't feel that last couple of years. So interested to see if they can do that on home turf without some of the restrictions that Wembley brings. But we will see. What have you thought of the four-hour blocks the last couple of weeks in general?
Oh, they have been a lot of work. I think they've tried hard to pace them and pace them well in terms of putting stuff at the top of the hours and trying to get things people are interested in. I think they've been a tough slog. I think a wrestling show longer than 2 hours is a tough slog. But I think that they've made the best of a... I don't want to say a bad situation, but the situation they've been in because of playoffs. And, if that gave them any, the ratings have held up well, which is secondary to whether I've enjoyed it or not, but they've been fine. They've definitely, I have not made it through a full one, live at all.
Okay. Well, I went to the first one and by the third hour, the crowd were done. Right, and by the fourth hour, people were looking around, and it just looked like they were like solemn eyed. They looked like I'm trying to think of something. There's a cartoon. It's one of the Warner Brothers ones where one of them's like the eyes are just like like Wiley Coyote. He's got like the red eyes.
Yeah,
and that's what it kind of looks like. And even though it was like an early time in the day in Colorado than it is, on the East Coast in the US, it was still like enough already.
So much wrestling.
Yeah, and I think they paced this week's a little bit better. But it is kind of feels like too much. But what kind of worried me is when you look at the ratings, they perform better with the two collisions than some of the recent Thursday night airings that they've been doing. Mm. And, they've got more opportunities with Thursday nights coming up. I think some of the Chicago shows are Thursday evenings. And there's quite a few coming up in the next few months. So you've got more chance to test that and hopefully promote it. And my hope is that Thursday would be preferential than having... 4 hours on a Wednesday night each week. They're going to try and promote it or try and get the strongest rating in each slot that they can. But they've done similar with this one that they did last year. So when they did the Dynamite and Rampage things last year, one at the end of March and one on May 1st, they had the big angle on the crossover segments. So last year was the Elite attacking Kenny Omega, and then we've used Omega in the last two. The first one a little bit more successful than this one this past week. But so they did a big crossover thing, and then what they've done kind of better, or they've looked at, and I've seen some complaints about this, so I just want to kind of explain why they do it, is they've put one of their big stories, be it either Tony Storm and Mercedes or Paige, involving Ospreay, Swerve and Moxley, in one of these slots after that in the start or middle of collision. So you had the Will Ospreay match and then the kind of Paige Moxley segment on Q10 on the first week on Fyter Fest. And then this week in Q11 you had Mercedes and Tony. And the reason they do that is when they did the Dynamite Rampage thing last year, that quarter after the main event angle dropped like a stone. In fact, the one on May, if you look at the one on May 1st last year, you'll see that from the Omega Elite angle, the next quarter, so quarter 10, drops by 37%. And when you've got, you can maybe get away with that when you have a 1 hour show, but when you're adding a 2 hour show on the end, you need to be able to sustain that viewership for longer. So that's why they're putting these people in these segments to kind of hold that viewership. And then you'll see it drop afterwards. And that's kind of what we've seen consistently through these. But I'm kind of a little bit worried about how successful the 4 hour blocks are. And I'm hoping that the Thursday nights will pick up to kind of fight against that a little bit.
Do you think that the Thursday nights are less successful? Like, my gut would say, okay, well, people aren't used to watching AEW on a Thursday night, right? They're used to watching it on a Wednesday, so they're just rolling straight into Collision and just keeping going and not going to bed, right? And so hopefully if they, as you said, advertise, promote, that problem goes away because people are like, oh, hey, this is a new night. I can watch them here because the 4 hours would be, oh, God.
Yeah, I think they haven't done a great job of promoting the ones they've put on Thursday so far. And I don't think they've put anything that was kind of must. You need to put big things on there. If you're going to do like a day change on a regular basis, you know, it's the same. You've seen it a million times before. Any show that's moved permanently to a new day has had it kind of thrown in the head. There's an awful WWE commercial from like the mid 2010s. Where they were moving, I think, SmackDown to, like, is it Thursday? And they literally kept repeating. You've got Dean Ambrose just repeating Thursday, like, repeatedly for, like, 10 minutes. And he's like, Thursday. But it's stupid, right? It's stupid. It's a funny reminder of where Moxley was and where Moxley is now. But it works because it's still in my head all these years later. Yeah, so you really do need to promote that hard and there needs to be kind of, you know, strong things on there. I think that's much more beneficial in terms of trying to, you know, because trying to promote, not just promote a 4 hour show, but trying to, like, you know, book and run a 4 hour show is so kind of time consuming and so difficult that having that split over two nights is much, much better. Having the two nights together would be much more beneficial for them from a logistics standpoint. It puts a lot less stress on their workforce that, you know, a lot currently are out Tuesday through Sunday in travel, you know, travel wise. So it would make a huge, huge difference to work life balance for a lot of their employees. And then it should mean that all of their major talent is available for potentially both shows, even if they're only going to work one, depending on how many dates on the deals and whatever else.
Right.
Yeah, I just think that that is much more beneficial. Do I think it might save us from Dynamite being extended still? No. You can see that coming with this week for Grand Slam. We're going 2.5. Yeah, that seems to, because I think they've established that they can do 2.5 over the last few weeks. They've been able to maintain the rating pretty well, not lose too much in that 10th quarter, and we'll see how that works this one. But yeah, we're in a content era, aren't we? But I think there has to be a limit and you have to be careful with it. But oh God, please on the Thursday night, we don't need the 4 hour blocks. And yeah, Saturday doesn't make any sense now because you're not going to get the lead-ins from the sports anymore as predominantly. You might get the odd lead-in from a college football game because they've got a few playoff games at the end of the year. You might get occasional hockey things, but what they've most benefited from has been the NBA lead-ins, and that's balanced out their overall numbers against the sports competition, against the WWE kind of flooding the market with the POEs, the NXT POEs, the Saturday Night Main Event, etc. So your best option is to come away from that, and Thursday makes the most sense for all the reasons that I mentioned.
Yeah. Trish, I said we would do this at one of our last episodes, and I feel like it's a decentest time to do it. Okay. What the fuck is going on with this Heart Syndicate shit?
Oh, no.
So, I'm torn between, well, horror when I have to watch it on television and hysteria when I think about it afterwards. But, so, when was it that we had this first start? Was it Revolution? Right? So
yeah.
Beginning of March? Right. So since the beginning of March, we've essentially had MJF joins the Hurt Syndicate. And there was a very long period where we weren't sure if MJF was going to join the Hurt Syndicate, and then MJF did join the Hurt Syndicate, and now MJF has joined the Hurt Syndicate. And that is essentially the story beats of that whole thing for 3-4 months we're at now. And the story does not seem to be progressing in any way. There's no credible opponents for the Hurt Syndicate. Every time they get a babyface team to come up against them, they crush them. I think Bobby and Shelton each took 2 bumps on Wednesday night.
No, they didn't, because they botched both bumps.
I know there was botching. I was bringing the botching up. But MJF was the one who had to bump his ass off because Bobby and Shelton are just not going to give anything to, I don't know, little guys who haven't been in WWE, people who aren't them. It's unclear. But, you know, and Brian Alvarez and Dave Meltzer talked about this on Wednesday, and I thought they did a good job of it. Like, there's no feuds. There's no programs. It's just these matches where they, you know, MVP runs the baby faces down. I don't think he said a single complimentary thing about them on commentary on Wednesday. They beat them. They don't bump or sell for them. And that's it. We move on to somebody else. And so as a result, you can see that anybody, any tag team or faction with any political power has stayed as far away from possible from them, right? Where, you know, people talk about it and they're like, oh, why aren't they facing FTR? Geez, I wonder why.
Like, yeah, FTR aren't that thick, you know?
No, they're not stupid. Like, but that's the part where I'm kind of like, where does this go, right? Like, ultimately, you'd think at some point there'd be an MJF match here, but how does that end? And I think one of the things that I'm really interested in, and something that our friend Mark Gallup brought up, is how MJF has really been little brothered in this situation. You know, MVP cuts him off. He's the one who has to take all the heat segments in the matches. You know,
he's bumping for three people after bumping for nobody for the last
years. He's bumping for three people after bumping for nobody. He's really, you know, I'm curious as to if he gets his comeuppance or if he gets his one over on them, you know, and or if it's like, you know, hey, brother, that doesn't work for me type of stuff. Like, I'm sort of interested whether, like, you'd think that at some point this would end up with some kind of match, but I'm not sure who there is for MJF to team with in this. And I'm not sure how this could possibly end in a singles match, right? Like, so where is this going? And I just feel like I'm in a place where I'm more and more certain that we're going to end up with some element of these guys sitting at home by Christmas, you know, pulling a Miro and cashing a paycheck because they you know, this the creative isn't what I want to do. It's just, it's such an odd thing because it seems like it's a throwback to 2023 AEW in a way that we haven't, like, we've gotten rid of that with a lot of other stuff, right? Or we seem to have gotten rid of that with a lot of other stuff. So I'm kind of, I don't know. It's just kind of a mess.
It's an interesting one because people say, oh, they're over. Well, you will be over if you're given that much TV time a week, right? And you get to run down everybody.
I'd be over if you put me on TV that long.
You know, like, yeah, of course they're over. Like, tell me who else gets as much time as they do, you know, with Max. Obviously, that's part of working with Max. You know, you're going to get that. You know, you're going to get those spots. You know, you're going to get protected with the ad breaks, which is...
Yep.
Yeah. Hey, yeah, Moxley, fucking stop. Just stop saying, I don't fucking care about my protection with ad breaks for, like, 3 weeks, please. Right?
Yeah.
Double eye breaks last week. What the fuck are you doing? Anyway, but yeah, it's not just Dave and Brian either. You know, Wade Keller's been on it for weeks now. He's caught up with it. You know, it's not just us and ONR that are going to bring it up since the start. But yeah, look at what they've got for Wembley. Are they going to have the Bucks? No. Are they going to have FTR? No. Are they going to have, you know, this babyface team that's going to team against the Bucks and Swerve struck on the Will Ospreay? No. Mm-hmm. Although I could see post All In potentially having, you know, an MJF Page program and then maybe, you know, Ospreay and Swerve. People always shout about this, but I could see it challenging them for it. And maybe that's how you get out of this. And then you can go into whatever you want to do with Max and the Hurts in terms of a feud or whatever. But yeah, like, the fact that there isn't this big match, you know, set for him, the fact that Speedball, who's hadn't barely taken a pin in AEW, was kind of just cast aside this week.
Yeah.
You're not building anybody. There's no program there. There's no one being built up from working with them. In fact, everyone comes out worse off.
Yep.
You work with them, you come out worse off. Why would you work with them? Hence why the bigger teams aren't working with them. It's not hard to understand. And it's like, rather than complaining, well, they haven't had a great pay-per-view match, well, maybe they should go out and work like they want one. Yeah. And not demolish them, and especially the commentary. You know, I think Wade Keller brought up the line last week where he just kind of laughed off at Speedball, and it's like, that's not helping a babyface, and you need to start helping babyfaces. And I do think it's slightly better than it was at the start of the year, but it's still not great, and it's something that needs to be solved over the summer. Yeah, they're cool. Heels shouldn't be cool. They have great music. Great. They shouldn't be there. Like, you have to understand, it's like, it's kind of like the John Cena thing, right? So the John Cena thing, it's like, he's getting cheered by the audience. He's the cool heel now, right? For a lot of that audience. He sells merch. He's got, like, they don't really sell much. But he still sells tickets, so he's going to give them those great ratings for the end of the year. But actually, this reign is doing a fundamental amount of damage to them that's going to sink in the long term. And that's exactly what we're seeing with this one. People won't realise what it's causing until it gets to the end. And then they'll look back on it in a completely different way.
Yeah.
That's probably a nice little cut across to WWE, isn't it?
Little transition to WWE.
Little transition.
Yeah, I like that.
So. So John Cena was pinned by Cody Rhodes last weekend. Had Ron Killings come back and interrupt the match after being kind of told that his contract wouldn't be renewed. and is now working Knight of Champions again in Saudi Arabia against one, let me check, CM Punk?
Yup. Oh, I'm so glad we had to postpone last week so we could talk about this. Didn't have to wait another week to discuss it because this week was so fun.
One of our newsletter contributors wrote me the greatest like fake pitch ever this week, and he's like, "Hey, if you're short of a feature this week, maybe you should just write, you know, CM Punk in Saudi Arabia, and then follow it up with 10 lines of laughter." And I was like, "Well." I was like, oh no. So they are doing CM Punk and John Cena, a nice throwback to the early 2010s. That wasn't supposed to be funny.
The whole fucking thing is so fucking funny. Sorry. I'm not gonna get through this.
It wasn't supposed to be funny.
Said serious face.
And brief. Okay. But yeah, so they're doing a throwback for the 2010s in Saudi Arabia, in the country that they are making a story out the fact that CM Punk said that he didn't want to go originally, and also said that anybody that did go, you know, can go and suck a blood-covered dick. Yeah, and even to the point where, you know, Cena's posting on his Instagram, you know, Samoa Joe and Miz in Saudi Arabia things. So we are making it very clear. But I don't understand what is going on here. I do, but it's really funny.
You know what's going on?
No, I know. But it's really funny, right? Here's what's really funny. So are we saying that nobody wants to go to Saudi Arabia? Are we saying that these are evil partners that we've been working with for the last, you know, 6 years? Is that what we're saying? Is that what we're doing in this story? Or are we pointing out and poking the bear that Punk agreed to go months ago, as Dave Meltzer said, and everybody knows that he's a hypocrite, but we're going to make it blindingly clear and obvious and flash it on our TV that this guy's brand doesn't mean shit? Is that what we're doing?
You know? Oh, that's what we're doing. We're taking this moral human shreds of self-respect being, from a broken man.
This moral human being, you know, who stands up,
voice of the voiceless,
stands up for the fans, does everything for the fans, does everything for his co-workers, gives them Starbucks gift cards. You know, this guy
tells them how great they're doing in matches.
Does, yeah, watches everything from start to finish. This guy that's, you know, left a number of major companies right now. Are we trying to destroy his brand, or are we just letting him destroy itself, or were we poking the bear into him doing so? What are we doing here? Like, I think this is hilarious because I can see what they're doing, but also he has nothing to say. Like, I'm watching that promo on Friday night. Yeah, he comes out, he gets the huge response from their audience, but he's not bothered about them. He's bothered about the likes of us and everyone else. Right? But he comes out and he's like, he doesn't even address it. Won't even mention the hypocrite stuff. Won't even mention Saudi Arabia by name.
Nope.
Right? And, you know, gobbles over his words. Maybe the crowd were too loud again this time. Maybe that's why it was. But just completely and utterly lost.
Dead silence for what felt like minutes, but was probably only 20 seconds, but literally stopped mid-promo, completely lost his train of thought. I really recommend watching the whole segment. I don't think WWE is going to put the whole thing up because of how fucked up it was, but you can find it on Twitter. And, like, just the part where he starts, and he starts off strong. Like, he feels like he's got somewhere to go, and then something just throws him, and he is gone, and he never gets it back again. And it's just the greatest hits, and Terry Funk, and Bret Hart, blah, 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 blah. And it's,
and the audience, you know, don't even know where they are, because most...
No, Lexington. Lexington, Kentucky. Like, dude, we're in a great wrestling city. Like, okay, you know. And it's just, like, he's like, we're just going to show the disrespect, John. We're going to do it. And it's, like, the lamest promo you've ever heard, right? Like, nothing interesting, nothing new. And I think even more than that, like, usually you can tell when Punk's, like, got a hair across his ass or he's worried about something because there's, like, a bazillion fucking leaked stories that you can tell exactly where they came from. And I think the thing that shocked me the most this week is how quiet he's been. There hasn't been a lot that's come out. Like there's a few people that you're like, oh, this is directly from him. The loudest you feel like it was the whole, you know, Dave getting very angry at Brian Alvarez and being like, you've made this story up in your head, right? Like, you've made up the whole Saudi thing in your head. That wasn't on TV. And then the next night it was literally on TV, which was freaking outstanding radio. But like, that's the part where I'm kind of like, what's going on in his brain? And then of course he did show up at the No Kings protest yesterday in Chicago, which, good for him for going. Absolutely respect it. You know, interesting that he chose to dress like he does on television, but we'll let that one go. I'm sure it was nothing to do with anything like that and all purely about whatever. But I just think the whole thing is, you know, he's fucked. Like,
yeah, look,
it's,
you build a brand, on morals, and that's your brand, and you tell everybody that you do everything that's right in the world, then you're always going to be stepping on rakes, aren't you? You know, because that brand doesn't exist. That person doesn't exist. No one's perfect in that way. But that's what you sold yourself on. It's not like, oh, you're just a hypocrite, just change your mind. No, no, you sold yourself on being this sort of moral compass. That's the brand that you created. That's why people were able to call you a hypocrite, and justifiably so. You know, it's not a case of, oh, everyone's changed their mind because everyone works Saudi now because the sports washing has worked. Well, yeah, but that's not what it is here, is it? I mean, you can easily overlook that.
And this is where, like, I'm happy to be slightly a little bit of a hypocrite here, because I think that one thing that, you know, I've talked a lot about on this podcast, and I'd probably throw you in on this too, but I'm never going to call you a hypocrite, Trish, is it would normally be a situation in which I would look at someone who was being humiliated by someone in a position of power over them, where they couldn't respond or do anything because of the situation they were in terms of their work and their public life. But considering, you know, how often CM Punk did that to other people, it's a little bit difficult for me to feel bad for him right now, given that this is a game he wanted to play in AEW, and now he's back home, right, where he's not there to make friends, he's there to make money. So make your money, buddy. Go suck your blood-covered dick and make your money, and, you know, get your... And that's the other thing that kills me about this, is that you know they dangled, we'll give you a match with Cena, because you know he desperately wants a fucking match with Cena. We'll give you the match with Cena before he retires, but it has to be in Saudi Arabia. And the fucking guy didn't even hesitate. Like, that's where the Instagram thing came from, where he was like, oh, I'd go to Saudi Arabia, right? That Instagram live thing he did recently. And I'm sure he knew it was coming as soon as they announced they were going to do a Rumble in Saudi Arabia and possibly a WrestleMania. Like, he's not going to give up those opportunities. It's just funny to watch people make him dance, right? And basically put him on television to show you how much of an absolute hypocrite he is, and how he's so stupid he can't get out of it, because he's his own past behavior has locked him into a room where he's like, the only thing sadder than Punk right now, like, is people still trying to defend him and be like, no, it's like, let it go, guys. I'm sorry, let it go. I know it sucks. I feel bad. Like, don't meet your heroes, but whatever. Like, it's just... And, like, beyond all that, what is this even match going to be like? Because Punk has never been good at wrestling, and his athleticism is poor at best these days, and Cena doesn't look like he can even fucking move.
He can't bump. He can't bump.
So, like, what is this match going to be? Like,
funny. This match is going to be funny.
It's going to be something you and I are going to enjoy. But, like, no.
Look.
Imagine paying $50 million for this. Oh, Schadenfreude is a beautiful thing.
The funniest bit to me, it's not any of that. It's the fact that he was posting, you know, not very long ago about people making donations public,
and he
was a shot at Chris Jericho, and now, like, you put yourself in a position where you do that's coming back at you too. So
yeah, he can't donate the money he makes from going to Saudi Arabia, because he made a big stink WrestleMania week about performative activism and how that's right. It was, you know, he donates lots and lots of money. He just doesn't ever tell anybody about it because CM Punk has never been performative his entire career.
But it's, you know, it's one of the things as well, is like, to rally a check on your worth, that, you know, the SummerSlam spot's not going to you.
No.
It's going to Cody Rhodes. So it kind of tells you what your level is as well. And I think, yeah, that's pretty interesting too, that it's like, this is a spot you get, not that spot. And
well,
yeah,
it's It's like the same people that are like, oh, he's going to take over NXT, and when he retires, he's going to have a role backstage and all this other bullshit. And like, sure, listen, anything can happen, and God knows I've been wrong. But all these people have done have made him, they've just made him dance on a fucking string and humiliate himself. I can't see any of them putting him in any kind of position where he'd have any kind of power. But like I said, you never know. Anything is possible. Maybe if he thinks if he's a good boy long enough. And maybe if we're lucky, we'll get another Mount Brooks explosion.
Just enjoy this, don't you?
Something just else to laugh this. At. Listen, like I said, I'm a petty bitch, and I like a little schadenfreude. All right. Well, there we go.
It's been a pretty busy week for WWE, so they also managed to get themselves a little rebellion going on with their fan base and a lot of their talent through some of their kind of non-contract renewals in the last few weeks. So they didn't renew Sarah Rowe, who had just been on maternity, which follows the same situation that they did with Carmella a few months ago. So neither of them being brought back to TV. I'm not really up on your legislation. In the UK, that's kind of illegal. You have to bring someone back to a working position for an amount of time before you can do anything. But obviously they're independent contractors. But that's a bit of a precedent that is a little bit uncomfortable to me at the very least. They also released Carlito, who was quite prominent on Judgment Day, in the Great Judgment Day. And they attempted to, well, not really, sorry, non-renew the contract. And they attempted to non-renew the contract to R-Truth. Didn't go well. So there were We Were Truth chants at Raw, at SmackDown, at the PLE, until he was actually brought back at the end. So that Nick Khan seems to be taking the glory on bringing him back. And he now is kind of Ron Killings, but kind of not. So announcers on SmackDown were just like refusing to call him Ron Killings now. because you know the people that wanted him back, they wanted back the R-Truth comedy character, but he's looking at his future and what he can do once this kind of Legends run is kind of through, and wanting to use the Ron Killings name that he used previously when he was in TNA and TNA champion at the time. So it makes sense to want to do that. What did you think that this whole kind of escapade what do you think WWE may have learned from this entire escapade?
So there's a couple of elements that, like, I think are interesting with this. I think the way that they capitulated so quickly, right, is interesting and sort of different. I know that WWE has kind of done that in the past. Blue Meanie, that was years ago.
Mm-hmm. Matt Hardy was another one.
Yeah. There's been a few of these, but in recent years, it's hard to imagine something like this happening, that they would, you know, let fan displeasure jump into this. And I think even more than fan displeasure, there was a lot of wrestler tweets about this, which usually WWE, the wrestlers don't really express unhappiness with WWE backstage stuff. But in this, you also had people tweeting about this being a mistake. I feel like WWE got real scared real fast about the crowds going against what they wanted them to say, right? Like, the crowds hijacked, what, like a show and a half, and all of a sudden the guy's back on TV? And I feel like it's, in some ways, a bad choice for them, because, first of all, Truth is, what, 53 years old, right? Yep. So even if you get, what, 6 more months out of this, it's not like he's somebody that you could downcycle and then cycle back up again. He's got a limited value to you in that way. And they had a bunch of big angles coming out of that Money in the Bank pay-per-view. You had Jacob Fatu finally turning against Solo Sikoa, and then you had Cody pinning Cena to set up a rematch of their title.
Becky Lynch winning the IC title
winning the IC title as well. So there was stuff that was going on, but that wasn't anything that got discussed like the day after it happened. It was all R-Truth, and it was all about, you know, him bringing back, and is it a work? And, you know, Triple H in the press conference, you know, trying to convince people that it was, but, you know, that almost immediately went out the window because everybody and their brother was like, it wasn't a work. Like, he has a new contract, which Truth himself, Killings himself confirmed on Instagram, and his son did as well. So I don't know. I think, you know, then he goes on TV and he's like, I'm a serious character now. I'm not the jokey character. But like, as you said, the fans liked him because he was that jokey character. If he's a serious character in the mid-card, do the fans care enough to bring him back, right? And I don't know. Like, I find this interesting. I question whether or not, like, they're still chanting for our truth, even though he's back. Anytime the word truth got mentioned in the promo that Punk and Cena did, they started chanting for truth. So, I don't know. I think this was kind of an interesting choice. It was interesting to me to see how quickly they capitulated, which suggests to me that they were more afraid of fan backlash than they have been in recent years, which would suggest that maybe they know that they're also starting to cool down a little bit, at least creatively. But yeah, this was pretty fascinating.
It's not even the first time in the last couple of years where they have kind of made a change because of that, because the Cody thing is still that. I don't know why we kind of write that off a little bit, but the Cody WrestleMania thing, you know, that was a huge fan backlash. And they did listen to it, and they did pivot, and they were successful out of it.
True.
But we've also seen the Cena response at this year's WrestleMania. You know, were they looking to kind of, the whole thing was, oh, we're going to protect Cody from, you know, being booed. And it happened anyway. So they're not having their entire way with things in the way that they weren't with that. And it is something to keep an eye on, especially when you have the Cena run at the top, which is going to get you the kind of the pop numbers from being the last run, you know, the merchandise that he'll hold up. As we said, you know, for last year, he's going to hold up their live ticket from this year.
Yep.
And the big question is what you come after. And when you do things like bringing back a 53-year-old man, you know, who has very limited scope in terms of, it's just going to have a match with Cena on SmackDown, but it has very limited scope in terms of being able to draw you numbers or anything else that's important to your business. And you're doing that over the top of, you know, your biggest heel stable at the current time with your Death Rider, your new Death Rider story. And then across your Bloodline stuff, and then across Cody pinning the world champion, although that seems to have gone nowhere for now, but it's come back, he'll come back. And then even someone like Mariah May coming into NXT and being brought in into NXT on that same week where all the headlines were always going to be about other things anyway, with When Worlds Collide and with the Money in the Bank pay-per-view, PLE, sorry. But to do that, and then on top of that, but the big story was R-Truth. So your big win of having your, you know, this is someone that we've got as a new signing from, who chose to come to WWE, who was successful in AEW, was practically wiped out because of what you did. And it's now whether they become fearful in terms of who they release and what they you know, and how often they release, which is going to be this key thing, because it's been this key thing continuously with WWE since TKO took over. Whether that now, does that fall to the wayside? Are you going to put that on pause? Are you going to continue, you know, are people going to start looking at them to see what to target? Is there going to be some media campaign if Karrion Kross doesn't get renewed in a couple of months? You can see that one coming a mile off considering the last few months, right? So you have this thing where they've had years of not having to worry about the fan response and that buy-in, and now that's slipping. But then also people are starting to look more closely at everything else going on around, and that kind of arrogance that we saw around WrestleMania, where it kind of seemed to implode on the media side and the PR side, you know, that is starting to kind of feel like it's breeding more and more into other things now. And, you know, seeing Triple H stood at his press scrum going, you know, it's all part of the show, when evidently everybody knows that it wasn't part of the show. You know, he's not doing himself any favours there with his talent. He's not doing any favours with anybody else. So, you know, that trustworthiness in the brand is quite important. And these are all the things that they were doing better than AEW over recent years that led to kind of changes in both groups in terms of popularity. You know, people felt that they could trust Triple H, they could trust his booking, they could trust his decision making. It's most people now seem to understand that he's the one making the decisions on, you know, contract renewals and the cuts and sort of thing as well. It's not like just this fatherly figure that, quote unquote, that he was made out to be. You know, they thought that they could trust the booking sort of thing, and people would always get to the top if they felt like they were getting hot, and now they get cut off because there's nowhere to go, because we've got Cena on top, and then we need to run Cena on Punk, and we have Cena and Cody, and all of a sudden, like, the top title was completely lodged off from everybody else, and there's nowhere for these anyone coming through to go, and they get stuck, and now they're starting to spin their wheels, and the mid card is not really a mid card because we're putting mid card belts on main eventers and that sort of thing. All the things that we saw in AEW kind of in 2022, they're all these advantages that they have, they're being chipped away at. And while their numbers hold, just like AEW's did through, you know, to the summer of 2022, there won't be that much discussion on it. But when they don't hold, and I think Cena is going to be so critical, once Cena's gone, what is left on this table? What have you not burnt? What is still going to drive you? What is building? Not, you know, what is static that's there that's been a draw for years? What is building that's going to pick you up? What's going to gain momentum? Because you look at this scenery, and I think this scenery is a disaster, quite frankly.
Yeah, and it's not been good. Look,
because I think they could have done more money out of him being a babyface and chasing a gun for him being the babyface world champion. I think they could have done far more money as him trying to defend, doing the babyface comebacks, not looking as fucking awful because he doesn't have to take the bumps as a babyface as he does as a heel. Like, they've made, this is a huge, huge mistake that's damaged Cody Rhodes, that is not allowing anybody to challenge for the belt. You know, look who's challenging for the belt. It's Randy, it's the greatest hit. You said it earlier, it's Greatest Hits Tour, right? It's Randy Orton, yep. It's CM Punk. Yeah, we're throwing R-Truth in there. You know, what's he got, like 18 appearances left? Who is gaining from this shit? And then you've got the other company now, and you've got to be looking out the corner of your eye and thinking, well, we've got a month. And then they're going to have a young guy that, you know, that's very identifiable with their brand on top. And then the people below him, or the people that are going to be feuding with him or in the immediacy, are also of that ilk. You know, your Swerves, your Ospreys, your MJFs, whoever else they're going to throw in there. It's not what it was a year ago. You know, it's like you need to wake up and smell the coffee. You're not where you were a year ago. And you can run off this legacy reign and you can think it's working and you can look at the numbers and say, oh, we're getting by. It's not going to get you by in a year. And this isn't a company that can get by with, oh, we're going to run this down and then whatever happens after. Like, you're hurting your own thing. And it's like this thing to say, oh, it's not important, they keep driving numbers. Well, they keep driving numbers so they don't. UFC was selling pay-per-views until all of a sudden they're not selling as many pay-per-views anymore.
Yeah.
It doesn't work like that. This is still a cyclical business. This has not changed that much. This whole thing that they can be hot forever is bollocks because they're not as hot as they were last year, and last year wasn't as hot as they were the year before.
Right.
That was the peak.
I think it's got to be scary for them when they look in the cabinet and say, like, okay, who are we promoting up? Like you talked about, who's coming up after Cena's gone? Like, what do we have? There's not a lot there, right? They kind of killed off Jey Uso. You know, they're not doing a lot with Fatu. I mean, he's getting overshadowed. I don't know. It's kind of hard to see, excuse me, what they're going to be able to do. And it also feels like we've talked about, the debuts aren't meaning as much anymore. Like you said, they dropped Mariah May on like an NXT. They didn't even wait and put her in the Evolution.
Pay-per-view. You could have put her on even the NXT Great American Bash head to head with AEW, and it would have got more headlines and would have been more impactful than what they did.
Right. Not only more impactful, but like I other people have talked about this, but her debut video was a shot for shot remake of a Sabrina Carpenter video. And, like, it's one thing to take something from pop culture and, like, reinvent it and do something different with it, but to do a shot-for-shot remake for somebody like Mariah May, and Tunnel Talk discussed this again today, which I'm calling back to them, but the fact that Mariah May and Sabrina Carpenter are not the same character. They don't have the same vibe. They're very different. So you're just doing a shot-for-shot remake because she's blonde, right? And you're going to end up in a situation that I kind of was expecting, which is you're going to have Mariah May doing a serious take off of the joking character that she kind of did, the sex pot joke character that she did in AEW, where now she's going to be doing the you know, I can't find the word I want, the like normal cliche one that you'd expect with these fucking old guys over, or, you know, like, so there's nothing new here. There's nothing interesting about this. You're just doing a shot for shot remake of a thing. It's the kind of cheap stuff that wrestling, you know, shouldn't be going for, but used to be kind of known for. It's like, I'm not going to do anything interesting with this, but I'm going to make some kind of a nod to pop culture. It just suggests that there's the least amount of care possible being given to this stuff, right? You've spent this, you've got this person coming over, they're here from AEW, you have a debut, this person was a world champion, this could make a difference, and instead we're going to do something really hacky and dump them in the middle of a Tuesday night, and like, that's fine, right? We're not going to take any advantage of this, we're not going to do anything with it, like, because ultimately it's not going to mean anything to us. It's just weird. Like, it's just like, it's, there's an oddness to it that I don't quite get, where, like, on the one hand, they're cross-programming like crazy, right? Yep. You've got two pay-per-views on the same day as All In. You've got Great American Bash, NXT pay-per-view during the day, and then you've got, well, it's not a pay-per-view, but you've got Saturday Main Event, which is a free pay-per-view, which they're throwing a Goldberg retirement match with 3 weeks of build-in, right? So, like, and like, God only knows what the fuck that's going to be like. I mean, you thought that CM Punk, like, poor Gunther's going to have to just carry the shit out of that. But, like, what? So they're putting all the effort and energy into counter programming, right? But then when mm-hmm. it comes to stuff like the debuts and stuff, it's just throwing this shit at the wall. It's like the actual booking is like, doesn't seem to be any care and thought to that whatsoever. So it's this weird dichotomy that I'm sort of struggling to be like, what's going on over there?
I think it's very hard to look at how they debuted Cody Rhodes, how they debuted CM Punk. But then even how they debuted Ethan Page was miles stronger
yes.
than how they've debuted Ricky Starks and how they've debuted Mariah May, or Blake Monroe as she is now. And I thought that was, I thought it was such an easy headline for All In Weekend when you want a counter program, than to be promoting, retirement match for an old guy while, Adam Page, 33-year-old, wins the AEW world title. And Tony Storm or Mercedes, depending, I think Tony's going to win that, but if, either way, someone else around that age group with a women's world title, and you're going to run Evolution the next day, and you're bringing back the Bellas, and you're going to bring back whoever else, because right. you're still going to use that pay-per-view, which shouldn't be on that weekend, because it's going to suffer from being on that weekend, but you're going to use that and bring back whoever else and still be stuck in this nostalgia part, which you have got away from. The whole build right. for the right. Bloodline, everything like that. I remember that the big 30th anniversary Raw show they did, and the yes. whole thing about how they were successful was the fact that this was a show that you thought was going to be built with legends, but was built around their current stars and their top story. And now we're back to feeding off nostalgia again and again and again as a matter of counter-programming, when all we're doing with this flooding the market stuff is actually hurting your own products in the long term.
We're going to do Women's Evolution 2, but, Nikki Bella's storyline is going to be all about how she can't get a man, or she doesn't have a man and Liv does, right? Like, what the fuck, right? Like, this is the kind of stuff that causes people on the F4W board to say the words Bechdel test, which blew my tiny little mind, but still, still happened, but it's true. Like, I don't think that, it's not 2005, it's not even 2015 anymore. You want to have a women's revolution, but you want women to just be talking about their relationships with men. People pick up on that shit. Women pick up on that shit. People want to say the stuff that they do on WWE, or Stephanie Vaquer doing her stupid thing with her butt, that finishing move, what is that called? Something with a kiss? I don't remember. Whatever it is, the one that Booker T goes berserk over. It's the same thing as Tony Storm making out with Mariah May. It's not, but whatever. Like, I don't know. There's an authenticity sometimes that you lose when you do that kind of shit. And I don't know. It's weird. I don't understand why they've moved away from what was making them successful. I think it's a positive, because I'm not going to lie. I'm rooting for WWE to fail because... there's so many reasons. There was another reason on Friday, was it, that we had Stephanie and Triple H hanging out with the fucking RFK Jr.
Which, for them at the moment, they think it's fine, because yes. this is a government with, reasonable approval ratings, and they'll think that they're on that right side in terms of their business. But politics changes very, very quickly, and that's, you have to be very careful how you illustrate your politics and those sort of businesses. At the moment, TKO thinks it benefits them. There will come a time where it doesn't. But the thing around the women, especially when it comes to Evolution, is you have potentially one of the strongest women's rosters, probably the strongest women's roster you've ever had in WWE. You have Io Sky coming off WrestleMania, who then has pretty much done nothing, who looked awesome and that should have been built on. You've got Stephanie Vaquer gone up. You've got Rhea Ripley, one of the biggest stars they have in the company at this point. Not male or female, just in the company. Becky Lynch is back and looking stronger, and I can take or leave some of the heel stuff, but she's still Becky Lynch. You've got, obviously, Lyra coming through with her, and then Bayley coming back and that sort of thing that they're doing as well. You've got Bianca Belair, who's just come back after the injury that she sustained at WrestleMania. They have this hugely strong women's roster, and we're going to use them just simply as counter-programming for press. We're going to put it a day after two other WWE events, so we're going to make it the weaker of the shows in terms of demand, because you're putting it against a retirement match, and we all know how that works.
Yep.
And then at the top of it, you're going to make the top programs, as I've already seen with Liv Morgan, and I'm sure that'll become a tag with the Bellas and that sort of thing, but we're going to make these returning kind of legends the stars of the show. It's counterproductive in so many ways, let alone the fact, I'm never going to agree with an all-women's card in the way that they're doing it, because it's all done to kind of go, look how great we are, we promote all these women card. But we're not willing to promote women's matches at the very top of our cards in WWE, you know? We're not going to put a match on the top of a PoE. We're just going to give them their own PoE, but actually we're going to make it secondary to the other PoE that we've got that weekend. Yep. And then we're going to say, when it doesn't do as well as that, well, you know, maybe that wasn't a great idea, or they're not as big a draws as the men. And it's just, I just think it's completely counterproductive. And the whole thing just feels backwards, because you have the advantage on that roster still, and the use of that roster still. You know, Tony and Mercedes on the AEW side, on the usage side, yeah, they are stars in that roster. They are stars in that company. But in terms of that usage, it kind of stops there. So WWE still have that advantage at the current time. And that's not to disrespect anyone else on the AEW roster. They're just not treated in that way.
Right.
So when you have that advantage, why are you chucking that away? These are all the things that we've laid out for years. And it's just like, it feels like you're chipping off like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, literally one after another. And eventually that there'll kind of be a comeuppance on that. I don't think it's that far away. I really don't. I don't think it's as far away as people think it is.
Well, we will have to see on that.
Do I have to talk New Japan now? Do I have to? We'll talk about it.
Talk about New Japan. You watched Dominion this morning, I did not see Dominion this morning. I felt very badly for many of my friends who were watching it based on their reactions. It seemed to have been the best of times and the worst of times as a show, with House of Torture essentially getting 700 new members, I heard. As many people as watch Dynamite on Max.
The funny thing was one of our friends in Japan messaged me on Friday morning, and he was like, have a guess on who you think, the ex is in House of Torture. And my first guess was like Chase Owens, and he ended up in House of Torture anyway today, even though that wasn't the ex. So it was kind of like, come on now. I was like, well, does that count for 2 out of 2? Because I got it on the second one. But it's like, does that count?
John Ballet.
Yeah, I had Fale. It's the second one, because it was just like, it was close. It's going to be Fale, right? But yeah, so this was an incredibly frustrating show in terms of there was some real good stuff on it. And then there was some stuff that made you wonder what the hell this company is doing. And it kind of illustrates a little bit of the crossroads that New Japan has been at, with a lot of the kind of confusion and difficulty this year and everything that's going on. There's lots of talk around their financials. I think probably people are sick around hearing about their financials. But you can see that they're pulling back. You know, the Tanahashi doing his last date at Forbidden Door and not on a separate New Japan show in the UK. So something about pulling back. The fact that we don't have a strong show at all programmed for the summer as we normally would in August currently, and none of them on the schedules for New Japan wrestlers right now or into the fall tells you its own story as well. So there are definitely some kind of dramatic changes being made to New Japan. I think they were about 600 down on last year, and I felt this card, as much as it looked kind of good on paper in certain aspects, was weaker in terms of star matches. You know, no junior title, which I think was a mistake. They've got El Desperado facing Jun Kasai before facing Kosei Fujita, who won the Best of Super Juniors. That is a mistake. And the junior belt and the treatment of it is probably a question. Whereas I think they've had some financial success running Korakuen Hall shows with the junior title on top. But I think it does leave something missing from these big shows. And then there was this mixture. So the top match, Goto and Shingo, was great. And the more I think about it, the more I think keeping that belt on Goto while everything else is insane is the right call. And you keep that going. And I did wonder, you know, that there feels like there has to be a lifespan on this reign. And especially from a drawing perspective, I think we were kind of all interested in the Dominion number. It is slightly down on last year, but not dramatically down, considering there is no Naito. You know, Tanahashi's not in a key spot, and everyone else that's kind of been missing. So I'm not too kind of... I thought that was going to be lower, to be honest, when you looked at where they were up to a few weeks ago than it is currently. Just going to have a look at 2023. Into a spreadsheet. On air, into a spreadsheet. There we go. Yeah, that was 7040. So it was still a little bit down on that as well. But it's a reasonable number for the card that they had. And I think you hope that the G1 and everything else is carried now by Tanahashi, in a way.
Yeah.
Who isn't a G1, as we wrote in the newsletter a couple of weeks ago. As expected, as is Takeshita, as expected. And Takeshita dropped the belt to Oleg Bolton in the other kind of highlight of the card. Kind of made sense because they had the match back at New Beginning in Osaka as well. So it made sense that he'd drop it. And that means that you put Takeshita in contention now for your top titles. He is going to be elevated upwards. I expect him to have a really strong G1. Him and Tsuji are the early favourites. Tsuji dropped the belt to Gabe Kidd. And in a match that, you know, unlike, I thought Takeshita and Oleg Bolton was kind of on the same level as the one back in February. This one, maybe it wasn't. And here's something that's interesting, right? So, obviously, we talked a lot about Paige winning next month. And yeah. Not uninformed either. But, so Gabe is using, like, the Death Rider is kind of his finisher now. So he wins his first kind of big singles belt in New Japan as a Death Rider, using a Death Rider. And it just felt like a really weird mix because, you know, that character has been very much, I'm the New Japan guy. And now we've brought right. in this American character without it really being on screen in Japan. And yeah, it was kind of a strange finish. And yeah, they did the promo after and he talked about his time and when he was, in the dojo during COVID, and then he had the breakdown and had to be kind of sectioned and that sort of thing. And he did the thing where, you know, teased the match with Tanahashi, which we'll see where they're going to do that. Is that going to be something they do down the line now with New Japan Soul Tour, or if it's something you're going to do for Forbidden Door or whatnot. But yeah, so he went back to kind of very strong babyface, but the finish kind of didn't feel like that. Right? It felt very much Death Rider, and with the Death Rider's momentum kind of, it's going to change, isn't it, after all in?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So it felt like a strange choice. I don't know. I felt that was a little bit weird. But yeah, I think it's quite an interesting time for New Japan. And I think that show showed the best and the worst of the kind of booking. You know, they they recognised the Goto thing last year and they put that into practice this year. And that's kind of sustaining them. You know, that's the bright spot. And that's the only time, when you watch that show, it's the only time it actually feels like a New Japan, a Osaka crowd is for that main event. That's the only one where you get that real noise. And then you had House of Torture. So the X thing, right, I don't care. Right, fine, you're going to do that. Maybe you put him in the qualifiers. Maybe some people beat him. You know, I believe that's kind of the plan or the idea. But they bring Dookie back. So Dookie had the horrific injury, if you remember, back at Wrestle Kingdom in the match with El Desperado. So you have a babyface return that's worth quite a bit, you know, should be. He was very popular during that reign, really kind of made himself a top player in the junior division in a way that most of us probably could have never foreseen. And we're just going to squander that by putting him in as the fifth guy in House of Torture. Maybe the seventh guy in House of Torture, but, you know, digress. Why? Like, and I've seen some storyline justifications, you know, like Just Four Guys have gone into Hontai and they've all joined together and, you know, he didn't really have a decision in that. But in reality, we've thrown away one of the easiest business things that we have this year on a year where we're losing kind of top draws left, right and centre. And we're just going to chuck him in this heel faction that people are sick of. That Tanahashi had made one of his commitments when he became president was, I'm going to get rid of the constant interference in the House of Torture, and we're going back to it. And maybe that was just for the Tokyo Dome match of Evil, but we're going back to it. And then you get to this chain match, which, look, if you want to play potential worst match of the year, you can watch this chain match, right? It's a David Finlay Evil chain match. And we've just seen the War Dogs get rid of the House of Torture from Bullet Club at Dontaku. And then we need to do this feud ender. And we do this feud ender. And the funniest bit, I'll tell you the best thing about this match was when Evil lost the chain off his neck. It just fell off. Like, you couldn't even pull it, it just fell off. But the whole thing is a disaster and it ends with, like, Evil completely destroying Finlay. And it felt like he was being written off, which is interesting because he's in the G1 lineups. But it would make you question, like, what the hell's going on here? Because it felt like a complete write-off and it was just an utter mess and it felt like completely the wrong direction. And I feel like almost if you hadn't had on the back of that the Goto Shingo thing at the end, I'd probably look at this whole card like completely differently, because you had like the worst thing you could ever see and one of the best things. So it's like it's like, that's why you feel like you're tearing your hair out, because you can see where they can go. You can see who can be elevated. I mean, they did the quick win for Tanahashi over Yuruma early in the card because they're going to do that back in the G1. And, you know, that's someone he's going to put over on his way out. But it just, I don't know. It's, they just feel lost. Like they're trying to find everything and they've got to balance, you know, all the other concerns and that sort of thing. And, but they just feel like they aren't as switched into what they need to do right now. So they're going back to the old tricks, and I don't think they work. And House of Torture is not the solution. It's not.
Why do you think they're so afraid to do any kind of shakeup? Is it purely financial? Is it, you know, like from a contract, like contracts perspective? Like, it just seems like people have been begging for the longest time for them to shake up factions, to shake up things, make things different, and, you know, focus more on the younger guys. And they just seem so reluctant to make any significant changes.
Well, the end of, you know, last couple of months, the word has been that they will be shaking up factions ahead of the G1. You know, we didn't think that would just mean, oh, we're just going to add people to House of Torture. You know, we've got people running around. We've got all the LIJ guys with no factions right now. You know, you need to, you can put something together. And, you know, there was a lot of consideration in terms of, you know, fantasy booking, that thing of maybe Shingo goes heel and he leads a faction. And then you can have Tsuji chase him down and you can continue the story that they worked, you know, coming out of the New Japan Cup last year. And that's not happened. And then you've got Hontai with a million people in it. And, you know, are we going to see some people split off and do their own thing? Are we going to see an Umbra leader group? Are we going to see an Umino leader group? Are we now going to see a Suja leader? No, we're not seeing any of that. And it needs to speed up big time. You know, they need to just look across the hallway, in essence, and look at Stardom and see that they're starting to, they, you know, have started to make those moves. And there's, you've got to look at their factions as well. And you need to look at it and do something with it, because there's no identity to a lot of these groups right now. They're not what they were. They're shadows of what they are or what they were in the past. And therefore, like, there's nothing to invest in. There's no one, there's not one group that you can identify and think identify as a success even, you know, at the moment. So, because even like, you know, have Gabe Kidd win a belt for the War Dogs, but he's playing as a Death Rider and Dave Finley is dead. Honestly, like, literally back to back, right? So it's like, what are you presenting as something that people could, because the idea is that you have all these groups and people kind of pick, it's like picking your football team, right? You pick something you identify with, right? So you used to have that, and you'd have, you could do that with Bullet Club, and you could do that with LIJ, and you could do that with Chaos. No one had a Chaos towel, who am I kidding? Or you could do it with Suzuki-gun, or, you know, and we don't have that now. There's no clear distinction, there's nothing. It's just a mess. It's a melee of people who don't feel like they identify with anybody. And then there's nothing that kind of connects them. And then we just kind of throw people together for these teams and that sort of thing. But the factions are very important in New Japan, because the way that you build these programs is through the factions or the tags, the multi-mans that you go in. So they've got to fix it. And they need to fix it now. Like, it needs to be in the next few months, because you're going to do the same thing that WWE are doing. You're going to sit on Tanahashi. Not literally. But you're going to... you're going to see...
Of us might enjoy that.
Well, yeah. But yeah. No, you're going to sit... we lost it now. You're going to sit on Tanahashi and you're going to use him for the end of the year to drive your numbers all the way up to the Tokyo Dome. But it's the same thing. You need to hurry up with what's next, because we need to get to what's next now, not just be talking about it. We can all see, like, people who are potential opportunities. And you went for Fujita, and then you pushed him back because you're doing this thing with Desperado and Junko Sai. It's not sending the right messages. I want to go in, I want to shake some of them. Like, like, get it sorted, because you've got, yeah, you basically, you're in the same situation. You've got 6 months. You've got 6 months to change this now, or I dread to think where we're going to look at February next year.
They always seem to start off the year so strong, and then things just... off a fucking cliff.
It's the nature, I think, of having Wrestle Kingdom and then into New Beginning. But then we normally have this kind of pick up of Dontaku towards Dominion and into the G1. And I think the G1 lineup's being kind of as expected, but no real surprises. And, you know, maybe there'll be a surprise name in the play-ins. You know, I want to see if Hiromu's going to be involved in the play-ins this year. We've got four names to go there. But there's no one that's going to kind of change, I think, the sentiment towards that too greatly, and I think that's difficult, but that's the position they're in, and I don't think there's a huge amount they can do about it, but the thing that they can do is to promote from within and start moving some of this youth up and taking some chances, to be honest, rather than going to the next guy, trying him for a year. It doesn't work. Okay, we're not going to acknowledge it. You know, they did with Sanada and things like that. And it's like, it doesn't work. So you need to break from that. You need to look at Stardom. Yeah, look across the pond, you know, at Stardom across the room in your Bushy Road offices and say they're very good at now elevating talent at a much earlier stage because they need to, because of the retirements, because of the movements of someone like Mina or whoever, or Fekla or whoever else. So, you know, follow their example. You need to, you basically, yeah, like someone getting them like a fucking running machine. Let's just fasten this up, you know? Yeah. Right. I've had my whine about New Japan now. I don't like whining about New Japan. So that'll do.
It's frustrating. It's always, listen, the most frustrating it is when you can see, listen, this isn't going to work, or this is a problem, or this is what you need to do. And I know you can do it better because you've done it better before. So why aren't you doing it now? That's when it becomes the most frustrating to watch.
It's going to be an interesting G1 series. And it's going to be interesting to see how they go through the Seoul tour and if they can get any momentum going into that, and then what the autumn looks like. And that will kind of be key for, we'll kind of know by then what we're going to look like come January. On February, but it's kind of an interesting time. I think I saw a comment on on the JCast Discord this morning during the show, and it was like, if Azawa had come to New Japan, they would have given him like a weapon and put him in house to torture, and he would have been nothing. And I was like, yeah, actually, it would have been, you know. And that's the problem when you're being lapped by Noah in terms of pushing a younger guys. And you know, I think the Endo thing could be quite interesting with Azawa going forward. Even if other things jump the shark. But yeah, when they're being lapped by that in terms of creative, in terms of moving forward, then yeah, you need to sort yourself out. Right. Have we got anything else? I don't think so. I don't think so.
Unless I think there's anything you want to cover.
No, I think we've crossed the globe a little bit. So I think that is it for today. Apologies once more for being a week out. It's my fault. I was dead.
It's not your fault.
It's my fault. I was dead. Also,
you were dead and I had no window to change the time. I was like, oh, shit. I can't do it any other day. But I think we made the best choice, all things considered.
Yeah. It worked out. And I don't regret.
We appreciate everybody who waited to listen to us. We
do. I don't regret coming across and seeing you and producer Leah.
No, I don't either.
Even if producer Leah told me my signature is like a fucking four-year-old. Thank you very much. getting to visit some friends in Denver as well. And got very excited at a baseball game. Probably don't let me to baseball games.
Many different sports arenas.
Indeed. This has been the Trish and Sarah Wrestling Podcast. We are produced by the wonderful Leah, even when she insults me. And she's playing with me.
You respond the same way to being insulted as you do to being complimented, so you can't blame her that much.
That just makes me British, yeah. Anyway, Leah is part of the wonderful Tunnel Talk, which is out every Sunday morning, Sunday morning my time especially. If you want a complete breakdown of the stories in AEW and to see things from a little bit of a different perspective, then please listen to Tunnel Talk on a weekly basis. You can also listen to all the other great podcasts on the Social Suplex Network through Red Circle or through your podcast provider. You can join us at the Social Suplex Discord, where you can talk to all the podcast hosts as well as fans of wrestling across the world. And you can catch us on the Social Suplex website on www.socialsuplex.com for the Social Suplex newsletter, which comes out every 2 weeks, which I'm going to go and finish off the very last section that needs input in for this week, since we've done this. Please read reviews, columns, some awesome columns, actually, as of late. And,
yeah, really good stuff.
Yeah, and some news that, and you know, the best thing is we're putting out quite a lot of news that isn't going out elsewhere, so look out for that one as well. But it's a really great collaboration effort that's had some fantastic additions as of late. Thank you especially to Eric and David and Alice for coming on board in the last few weeks and months. It's made our coverage just insane, the amount of things that we can cover now. Probably the best coverage of Asia that anybody in the world, honestly. And hopefully we can get our other global sections up to the same level as well. You can support us through merch at ChopTees, www.chop-tees.com /social suplex, or for our podcast itself, it's /Trish and Sarah. I think that's it for today. We'll be back very, very soon. I'm sure there'll be lots to talk about. Money in the Bank. Not Money in the Bank. Oh, God, I ruined a whole line. I had a whole thing. It's fine. Night of Champions will be coming up by the time we do this again. So,
Oh, God, Night of Champions. That'll be fun. Listen, yeah, that was, I don't know if you can tell, but I enjoy a little Schadenfreude session or two. What can I say? I'm a catty bitch, and I'm just going to lean in every once in a while.
Yeah, and Triple Mania Regios tonight, so it'll be interesting to see how that works out as well, and whether that's at the same level as When Worlds Collide, which was, you know, the old NXT TakeOver style show, because they use all the good AAA talent, so we'll see what this show is this evening. But until then, I've been Trish.
I've been Sarah.
This has been the Trish and Sarah Wrestling Podcast, and we thank you for listening.